Welcome back. How many of us were in the theatre last night? Just a good plenty. This session has been built as a collective review on As You Like It, and we're all of us going to be approaching this in different ways. But all of us did share yesterday, so we've gone through yesterday, and we'll have that in our minds. We were very keen, Paul, Pete, and I, when we were thinking about how this session might best work. But it really was a time for everybody to be able to speak to each other, to be heard by other people, and that we all had a chance to air our views on the film. So the way we thought we'd do this, and it's a bit of an experiment, but the way we thought we'd do it is that we'd begin by working for 5 minutes in pairs, and then working into a larger group, eventually into a bigger discussion. So the model is that we have gradual consensus, and then we smash consensus and go back into individual voices. So you get both as part of the reviewing process. So we'll see how it works by your indulgence. And really, the first, I'm going to carefully time it as well. So we'll have just minutes at a time, and gradually by in about 20 minutes' time, we'll have smaller groups feeding back to the bigger group, and then we'll go into a larger circle. So you're going to be moving around a bit with your chairs, so bear in mind not to crash too much into each other. So talking to the person sitting next to you for 5 minutes, can you try to come up with about three things that you... benefits of working in pairs. Now, in theory, the room has been set up in such a way that if you, on a row of four, can turn to the other people or near you to make a group of four for a further 5 minutes, critical questions and issues raised by the production in groups of four, please. So, feel free to be able to share chairs.
Thank you.
the chairs, because we're moving into groups of eight. Now the groups of eight, so feel free to move the chairs out of this kind of bunch in the middle. The groups of, before you move, the next part is a sharing of those issues. And at the end of 10 minutes, we'll need a spokesperson in each group of eight to call back to the whole group of these, what your group would like to say about sharing questions and issues to call back. So group of eight, the spokesperson at the end of it.
In the spring. And yesterday on the panel, I mentioned that he was the director of As You Like It, and Tim has just come up to me to say that several people have spoken to him this morning about his production of
And that's nice.
He's playing every time, Carol.
So this is Tim Supple, and that wasn't his As You Like It. Okay? Now we can proceed.
That was a very important announcement.
I'm going to go to the next slide.
Thank you.
has each group got a spokesperson? Okay. We're going to allocate 2 minutes per group for the spokesperson to deliver to the rest of the room what your group has been discussing, what you'd like to feedback, and I'll time that by 2 minutes. So can we start with this group here, please? Tom, you're the spokesperson. Off you go.
I suppose our group's feedback would be summed up by the idea of a curate's egg.
Here.
You can't hear it. Oh, there, here we are. Sorry, I'm holding the wrong one. A curate's egg, I guess. I.e., can it be good in parts, or does, you know, or is it bad? Is an egg which is a bit bad, just a bad egg? The bits that we have problems with are the design, which when someone called it perverse and lazy, no one was prepared to defend it. It didn't seem to allow space or a location for what the production needed to do, we thought. The specifically lazy idea, I think, was mainly that the forest was built in the interval by stagehands rather than during the action. And often the action, like carving on trees, didn't have a place for it to happen. Something else was brought on to facilitate it. That said, the cardboard extending down the road afterwards was praised. I don't know, I didn't notice that, but apparently the poems continue as you walk away from this. There was a question as to which of these people were poets, really, and was this poetry really conceivably coming out of any of these characters? Orlando, I think, scored low there. Singing. The singing was rated nice, but unclear, or sometimes nice, and often unclear. As in, what is the function of music in the production? What is the music doing? And I think the biggest point, probably, was to do with the use of the ensemble. I.e., there are 21 actors there, and how many of them are doing something really fulfilling and challenging, and how many of them are standing around pointing guns occasionally? That sounds very negative, but I mean it. We all felt, I think, that there were positive versions of all of those problems which were presenting themselves to us, but not necessarily in the production. That's me.
Thanks, Tom. This group over here, who's the spokesperson? Got to talk quite firmly into it.
I think, share the curate's egg position, previous group. We felt that one critical question which faces modern practitioners who are presenting classical texts is how to make it relevant to a modern audience, a Renaissance text. And we didn't feel that this was successfully done through the rather vague use of costumes, changing from Renaissance costumes through to modern costumes was puzzling rather than helpful. But the question which presents itself to practitioners is a genuine one, one that we as audiences have to ask ourselves: how do we make these plays relevant in terms of their design? Audibility was an important issue in our group, and the critical question then that needs to be asked is to do with the training of young actors coming in drama school versus speaking. And we thought, in relation to what Tim Supple was saying yesterday, that if he needs 5 weeks of text work on a 6-week rehearsal run, that maybe he should have 8 weeks, so he's got 3 weeks at the end to work on the text. Idealistic, I know, but if that's a problem, then. And also, one member of our group said that clearly the 2.5 year, the long ensemble, which is building in training for these actors, is a very, very good idea if they're coming out with those skills. And then conflating Ennion and Jaques was confusing. So again, how do you handle the text, and why do you do things like that? And the set design, we felt, also was limited because it wasn't using or sensitive to the demands of the courtyard. It was effectively a proscenium arch set design, and so forced an outward movement rather than using the full space of the courtyard.
Sorry.
Thanks very much. Ms. Screen, please. Thanks, Alison.
I'm right in the middle, so I won't try and face everybody, but try to cover the group and touch promptly if I miss things up. A lot of what's been said applied to us as well, certainly in the sense that it was a proscenium arch design. We talked quite a bit about the shape of the theatre and problems with what you got, depending so much on where you sat, so that people sitting in the silence really did not get the effect of the trapdoor opening, the opening up into the forest, and the relationship between Celia and Rosalind being confusing. Whereas if you sat straight on, you got a much clearer picture. I think some of us felt, perhaps in contrast to a lot of what's come out so far, this is going very up and down, have I got this right, that there's quite a lot of negativity coming out of people's comments here, and a lot of us really enjoyed it and felt there was a warm feeling. Getting some nodding heads here. There were things to irritate, but perhaps our curing say is half good rather than half bad. We were concerned about Audrey. We were irritated by the depiction of Audrey, and just quite how it was stereotyped. And we didn't really know what the problem was of having a teacher around on those dinners. It was quite as constant. And we were also a little concerned about the, or some of us were concerned about the conflation of Jacques and Amion. But others of us felt if you took the production on what it showed you rather than on what you already came with, that worked very well, and that his singing was riveting, was a kind of high moment of the show. That one, 2 minutes.
You were right. Keep going.
Oh, right. Then. Right, well, yes, did I cover that? The Rosalind Celia relationship. And there was a real sexiness, I'm talking here, but there's really much sexiness between the two main characters, which she really liked.
This group, please.
Again, we're going to repeat some of what you've already heard. I think the major things we had to say, we did like the set in the sense that we appreciated watching the characters watch what was happening on stage, so that we had a sense, particularly if you were sitting in certain seats, that we could see the actors, characters in that series of window boxes watching what we were watching as well, and we could judge their reactions. We were a little confused by the fact that it seemed as if this particular presentation only emphasized the giddiness and the exuberance in the play, and that we lost any perception of the darker side of the enterprise, that it could turn sour, that there might be an ending that would be unhappy. We wondered whether, particularly in rehearsal, that darker side had been explored, and if so, had it been discarded, or was this just a particular nice variation on a theme? We were concerned about what, for a better word, would be the stakes that were in the play, that it didn't seem as if the stakes were high enough, particularly as we moved into the second act. We felt the first act, the characters needed to involve the audience and needed to tell their story, and that by the second act there was no sense of danger that Orlando might not come, that time might run out, that things would be spiraling out of control.
Just 2 minutes, thank you. Miss Group here, please. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Hi,
can
everyone hear me?
Yeah,
we had a slightly different take because I think the makeup of our group is quite mixed in age range, which was lovely because we got some far more positives. Some of the things that have been raised, I mean, I raised the set question and because I was at the side, I didn't get any of the things they were doing with the set because I couldn't see it. So, I mean, that was a real problem for me. We liked the way that the court changed when the girls went into the forest, that the tightness of the clothing then became much looser and sort of reflected the freedom, and we felt that maybe the girls at the end in those costumes sort of found themselves. They weren't going to go back to that rigid court appearance. We had a problem with, I'm sorry, I think they're the first to mention the rabbit, in itself.
Lest we forget.
Okay, but it pulled the whole focus of the production. People go out talking about the rabbit. So it's a distraction from, you know, what the play is trying to do. We felt there was a lack of relationship between the men in the forest, and I think that goes back to someone's view that there were a lot of people on, but they weren't working as an ensemble. You didn't get that sense of comradeship in the forest. You didn't get any real depth between Orlando and Adam. Because there was no real feel of companionship in the forest, what Jay Cleese was doing was then affected, because he doesn't stand out quite so much as that pained individual. On the whole, though, I think most of us liked it, but I felt there wasn't any great depth, emotional depth in it, and, you know, on the whole, though, we wouldn't rate it 6, 7 out of 10.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Let's try this. Instead of me speaking to the whole group, what we'll do is we'll do 3 words each. because I don't want to sum up any answers. So we had some really interesting things to say about the set, which perhaps you'll address in a moment.
I think you should have more than 3 words.
More than 3 words. But well, my only word would be epilogue, and I was just baffled by the. And it wasn't Tim's production, but. Tim also did something interesting with his epilogue at Leicester. So, just thinking about the way that critics have talked about the play in relation to coming working backwards from the epilogue and what that means, the fact that it wasn't there last night and it was kind of given a feel-good Irish tiddly-away flavour was peculiar, I thought.
Sporting
word,
please.
Sorry, I apologise.
Yes, tell us what you've heard about the epilogue.
Oh, the question of the epilogue, yes, sir. I approached Michael Bourne about this. Also Katie Stevens. And Katie, first of all, said, well, Michael didn't think it was appropriate, he wouldn't go any further. So as a result of that, I wrote to Michael Bourne, and his reply was, he felt that the production itself was too joyful, too light-hearted, and he had played down, and we found, so the dark part of that, he liked it. Anyway, so that was that. You see, thought the epilogue, as it stood, was too apologetic for a production of this sort. Anyway, you take that as you with you a few minutes.
Hey, John, speak please. Tell us about the other side of the doors.
I liked the design in the sense that it's a very typical shape for a thrust theatre. The Crucible in Sheffield. And so on frequently does it's a bit like an open book, really, isn't it? And I personally thought that worked well. I thought that occasionally they didn't play so much the sides, but I thought shape was there for them to do that. The doors, when the doors opened, the only problem I had, you could see the structure, you could see it laying lightly on the structure of the building, except that when the doors opened, they were seen painted. And that suddenly, demolished everything else.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
The opportunity for individual voices to be heard after the next group has spoken for 2 minutes. So our final group, Bridget. Thank you very much.
Hello? Is that? Yeah. Like the group on the far side of the room there, I think the overall sense from this group was that the stakes in this production just weren't high enough. We talked about how it's quite difficult to make the stakes high and as you like it, in comparison to plays like Comedy of Errors and Twelfth Night, where there's this wonderful sense of characters thinking people are dead and the joy of them not being. You know, Rosalind's dad's
only gone to a wood to do folk singing. But there are extraordinary stakes in this play that we felt that weren't mined. So there's no real sense of the economics of Arden in this production. No real investment can happen in who's left behind if they're all idiots. And there's all, you know, the iconography of the white stiletto is just an obvious Essex girl thing to laugh at, as opposed to, you know, somebody who has a kind of economic stakes in this world. And really, no, we didn't feel any sexual stakes either. We didn't feel any kind of strong chemistry between Orlando and Rosalind. We talked about the fact that in this play, very young women are catapulted into a world in which they have to cope with hardship and sexual feeling. And we talked about how Tim made the point that quite often Rosalind is played by a mature actress because it's a difficult part and an enjoyable role, and how, what does that actually do to a play which is about a very young figure being catapulted into experience? We talked about Hymen. We doubted that, Stanley certainly doubted that Corin as Hymen could work, but I think we also felt that because the stakes hadn't been played out, it wasn't possible to see whether that could work. We were uncomfortable with the extra textual stuff and felt perhaps that the actors weren't even comfortable with it. Touchstone trying to get the attention while the rabbit was being, it just didn't feel funny, and he didn't feel he was funny perhaps.
That's too nice for it.
So yes, stakes aren't high enough, thank you.
Thank you very much to all of the groups. The next part now requires a bit of delicate room shifting. So please, can you all, with great grace and tenderness, gather yourselves into a largish and as tidy a circle as we can, please. Thank you.
The Oxford Drama School
does a very rigorous Shakespeare training there. Head George Peck is very keen that his students should learn to do the Shakespeare language, for want of a better way of putting it. The RSC casting director went up there a couple of years back to do a workshop with the students and didn't like what George Peck was doing with them, because they said, we don't look for that anymore at the RSC. We look for them just being natural. And we're not bothered about them learning the rhythm and the, you know, the line and all the rest of it. And I think that perhaps says something about the speaking of the text that is present with some of the actors at the moment.
Sorry, I have to question that, because I know the RSC spend a lot of time working on that. They have the greatest verse speaking expert in the world, since Berry. It's not true. And if that person said that, they weren't speaking the truth, or it's slightly Chinese whispered. I mean, you know, we may or may not like the way they speak the verse, and that will be very personal between us. And the whole issue of verse speaking is, I think, extremely complicated, and we mustn't be simplistic about it, because of course we don't want our actors to sound like people from the 1920s. Of course they must sound living and natural, but of course they have to engage with the absolutely how that verse is, so they shouldn't sound like they're on TV. And yet, it's a deeply complex thing, and I think, for good or bad, the RSC spend an inordinate amount time, more than any other company in the country, whether you like the results or not, but they certainly do devote the time and energy to do it.
But with that, you know, I think prose speaking is more important than verse speaking.
Exactly, and it's actually very difficult. But all I'm saying is
that, poetry, really, as you like, is improved.
All I'm saying, Stan, is that I don't think we can sit here and accuse the RSC of not attempting to address this, whether or not we think they do it successfully.
We very nicely started exactly what I hoped was going to happen. The idea now is that it's open entirely to us as individuals to say exactly what we want to say. The only ground rule, and I'm stepping aside now as chair of this next bit of the session, it's in theory chairless. The only ground rule is that we listen when someone else is speaking, and we don't speak when someone else is speaking. Okay, that's the only ground rule. There is a microphone that I'm holding if people don't feel their voices can be heard, or if you have a problem hearing, you can come and get the microphone. But if you just try and speak up, the acoustic in this room is quite good, and it is quite good with a circle, because it works really well with those two groups. So we've started talking about verse speaking. There are some prompts behind me on the screen. How did the production make you feel? What is worth remembering about this production? How does this production speak to our times? Why is your opinion valuable? Was there a moment that encapsulated this production? What difference would you like your review to make? The floor is open.
May I make a comment? Carry on the verse, I don't need that.
If you speak to the room, I'm no longer the chair.
All right. May I make a comment about, I can't do this anywhere else really, about the two perhaps leading actresses. One, who emphasised every word, gave each word a different quality, and the other one, who spoke the lines. Thank you.
I like to answer three questions. How did the production make me feel? Really exhausted. I never not go to the pub, and I went straight home to my being here. How does the production speak to our times? And I think that was its key problem, its attempt to speak to our times through costume. I thought it was quite patronising. And why is my opinion valuable? What a great question, I've never said this. I think my opinion is valuable because I used to teach comprehensive school children, and now I teach university students. And I think that production spoke to both groups in slightly patronising ways, even where it succeeded in engaging. And for me to speak to our times, production needs to have, as we said in our group and as the other group said, very strong dramaturgical and dramatic stakes in the moment of its production, so we can engage with its 400-year-old strangeness and its possible relevance. And we don't need to have speaking to our times imposed on us with young women teaching around in white stilettos. So that's it.
Could I second that? Exhaustingness, especially with regard to the Touchstone and to Katie Stevens Rosalind. I found watching Stevens like watching a Kate Winslet acceptance speech that went on for 2 hours. Watching the Touchstone, I was reminded of that famous line about doing comedy. If they can see how hard you're working, you're not working hard enough. And boy, could I see Richard Katz working hard.
I think sometimes we get a bit hung up on, or directors might get a bit hung up on relevance, because for a lot of theatregoers, and I'm not just talking about older theatregoers who've seen a lot, we can pick up the relevance of something without actually having it underlined 3 times. So what you get is this is the concept, and this is what we're doing in the concept, and you go and you're thinking, yes, I can see what you're saying, but you don't need to keep on saying it over and over again. Why don't you just do the play and let us pick up the relevance of what, you know, to our times? You know, and I sometimes think that maybe there's just a bit too much of a hang-up with that, to making it relevant. It's a good idea.
And, I mean, what you're saying is, I think the relevance is always linked up to what you said before. It's linked, tightly linked up with the stakes, and that's what we came up with, like in rehearsals. Like, the further you go down that road into what you don't know, what none of the people in the group have met yet, if you go there together courageously, and so that's the director's task to encourage you to go there as an ensemble, and then that would take you into the second half of the play. I mean, it's the same issue with the Winter's Tale production. So this sheep-sharing thing, how do you make that relevant to us? You don't need to put it into a stock market or whatever. I mean, just that won't work, obviously, but how you can have Juno and Hymen or whoever in there, any kind of goddess, but you need to really explore how it links to you, and really explore how, where that one word ends, of where the sounds end of one word, and how far you can take that. And I felt that was sort of lacking in the production, and also the night in the production the night before. And I think if you do that, then you don't have to think about relevance. It's sort of about exploration.
Just following on from that, it seems to me that when I find relevance in a production, a relative word, it's because I can see something of myself in the production. That's what allows me to engage with it. I didn't see very much that I could identify with. Relevance to me is not necessarily being reminded of current affairs. It's being able to engage on a human level, on an emotional level, and in an imaginative level with what's going on in front of me. And I found that really hard with this production. Set that alongside something that Janet Sussman said yesterday, which was ringing in my ears. I love the comment when she said that actors need to make Shakespeare's language as surreal as it really is. And I think As You Like It, of nearly all the plays, has that balancing act between the emotional relevance of love and the change that it can make, and a magical exploration and survival, and however you want to explore the economy of the forest, against this surreal language. And I certainly didn't think that the language, as I heard it last night, was surreal or dazzling or vibrant. And I didn't engage with it very easily for other reasons. The most engaging part for me was when Orlando was singing his song before he said, "Hang there, my verse." He was in the little window above the centre exit with the moonlight on him, and I thought, there's something very real about this moment. I can see where he's coming from, I see how he's feeling, I believe in his commitment.
Maybe perhaps one of the problems is to do with a crisis of style. Jonathan Miller said that when he began directing Shakespeare, he felt himself browned between two millstones of idiocy. On the one hand, authenticity, on the other hand, high conceptualism. And watching that last night, it seems to me that the RSC, or this production at least, this production, doesn't know whether it wants to be the Globe or the Berlin Ensemble. So you actually have to go check the hotel. You have an attempt at a kind of chilly aesthetic that you might see in Germany quite a lot. But in terms of the acting styles, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know whether they're playing the Globe, as it were, or they don't know whether they're playing an alienated style, which they're certainly not properly. So that seemed to me a great problem, and I think that led to a lot of confusion on the part of the audience.
It's very similar to the point I want to make, because where a lot of the insights into this production and this play are things that I would want to write into a review. I think because of the year that I've had of seeing Kim's production, the production of the Globe, and then this production, wants me to think about those companies or those theaters and what I take into Tim's production from his previous work, what I learn about this new theater in Leicester, what I think about the RSC and the things that some folks have been talking about the RSC, and what I think about the Globe and their project. Now again, different directors in these different theaters are going to do different things, but that's part of it. And for me, I guess the difference I'd like my review to make is to think somewhat about what companies, what theaters, and what directors are thinking about as they put on productions of a play. And to be able to do that comparatively across one play, with one play in a year, I think, for me, has been quite useful to think about.
There was one moment that no one has spoken about, which I found both surreal and slightly horrifying. And I don't understand how it could possibly, I mean, I think it shows exactly what Paul is saying, is this absolute confusion. But a burning cross.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. A burning cross mean that isn't offensive. I mean, everything else is slightly, you know, if you say patronizing, a little bit boring, but then suddenly there's this moment, and then it's gone. And it's supposed to be a funny moment, and I'm just, anyone should have any idea what that would be.
I mean, it's held by an idiot, a cross held by an idiot. I mean, that man had
a religious idiot.
Or whatever.
Yes. And a great thing with that moment, last night particularly, was that it seemed, if it picked up on anything, it picked up on two moments of borderline racism in the audience, it seemed to me. One was when Charles was told that he looked pale.
Yes.
And we could register an audience response to that. Well, he's not yet. He's black, ha ha. And there was another moment slightly later as well, a different black actor. I started to feel very uncomfortable with this. And then type of burning cross, which, as you say, if it means anything, that is offensive. Well, what's going on? What's going on there?
I think there's one other thing about the burning cross that sort of epitomized some other things that happened in the production, is that it took him out of the production rather than took him in. I personally, even though my rational brain said, well, of course they've done it 1,000 times and there's no danger of fire, the minute that cross was taken near that set and all that straw, my mind went to, oh my God, do I know where the fire is? And that's not what I'm sure the director wanted to be in my mind, but I think that also happened with the skinning of the rabbit, that it became something that took us not into the world, it took us out of the world, and so worked against, unless they were really trying for a Brechtian effect to alien it, which
just speak.
Well, I find this fascinating. By all accounts, actors adore working with Michael Boyd. The rehearsal process for actors on a Boyd production, they find just extraordinarily engaging. And against Tim's production, you have, 6 weeks? Yeah? They worked on this production for 12 weeks, and part of that was just getting the ensemble together. Okay. But it also strikes me somewhere that those actors don't actually know what it is that they're putting on stage. And that they, because they never see it, they take all the stuff in that rehearsal period and put it on stage. I sometimes think to myself that their sense of what they're doing, they must be giving their absolute best performances in the rehearsal room. And I also think by looking at that stuff, that Michael Boyd was not operating as a director in the edit function. That he was not, as a director, saying, that's very interesting, but it makes such a local impact that it is pulling away from the whole.
And it'd be even better if you didn't do it.
I'm sorry.
It'd be even better if you didn't do it.
Precisely. It doesn't seem to me that the directorial eye taking all of what was possible from that rehearsal period and then moving it, changing it, and bringing it into a production that spoke across the whole production. I didn't find that that was happening. So for me, it was a kind of terrible collection of different kinds of points coming out of different kinds of traditions. And I think that's brilliant what you said about, you know, the two pulling apart. That clarifies something for me. So for me, that's what a good review does. You've just taken something that was inchoate in my mind, and you clarified it for me. Can I grab that, please? Or is it going to be in your review? Can I have it for my review? But for me, that was kind of what was going on. And I think that the Burning Cross had to do with one of Michael Boyd's pet ideas about the notion of the spoiled Catholic priest. I think that that's where that was coming from. The Irish boy, the spoiled Catholic priest. But I also found it, you know, that he was a hedge priest. That's what the tradition, that he'd been defrocked, he'd been thrown out into Arden. Can we read any of that? No, because all of these other images of the Burning Cross and the Ku Klux Klan were suddenly on top of our, you know, imagination of doing that. But I also, going back to that moment of racism, who of us saw last year's Taking of the Shrew? When Merrington Walker came in as the Pedant of Mantua, speaking as though he were Oxbridge educated, and then at the moment when he said, oh gosh, I might be recognized, he suddenly went into Jamaican patois. And I thought, this is so offensive, I don't know what to do with it. That what you have just played into a really nasty cliche. And I don't know why it is that actors don't say, I'm not going to do that. I'm just not.
It's so interesting, Carol, that you bring that up about actors enjoying working with Boyd, because I'm so glad you said that, because that's exactly what I was wondering yesterday. Is this a rehearsal process in which somebody can say, I think it would be great if I had one of these, and Boyd says, yes. Because I thought exactly that of the Boyd play for Romeo and Juliet about 10 years ago, when Lady Capulet has a glass of wine, inexplicably, when she and Capulet are telling Juliet that she must marry Paris. And I'm starting to think backstory, I'm just starting to think, does she have a drink problem? I'm thinking about psychological backstory, which actors love to explore, or a lot of actors do. But you've got to edit that, as you say, and it feels like my character would have one of these.
I think to follow the logic of what Carol has been saying, when she goes to take it one step further, I don't think the director has confidence in Shakespeare's comic art. I don't think it's about a rehearsal. I don't think he doesn't know what to do with a great Shakespearean comedy, and especially one that's so tricky, so teeters on the edge, as Kim was saying a while ago. As you might, it's terribly difficult. It's not so emphatic as it becomes in Much Ado or in Twelfth Night, perhaps later play. This is the first essay in a real tragic comedy, leaving out the comedy barriers. This is the first essay in tragic comedy. He's not quite there yet. A young actor, utterly unknown at the time, who played Touchstone in Stephen Pimlott's As You Like, named David Tennant, anybody heard of him? wrote a superb essay on Touchstone and on that production in one of the plays of Shakespeare. And he says that we, the director, and I decided that we must have confidence in Shakespeare's writing, and that we would not overload the part of Touchstone, the stand-up numbers, with a lot of extra gimmickry. Mm-hmm. Other actors might be well to read that essay, they're going to take the part of that story. Mm-hmm. And other directors might ask themselves, do I really want to do a Shakespeare film?
I can pick up on that, and again, I agree, critically valuable. The question of value is a great one. I suppose my opinion is valuable because I am a director. And it struck me yesterday as Tim read out from, that was Michael Billington's review. Now, what Billington was doing, I slightly disagree with Tim here, I think, in that he was not, I thought, describing acting, but describing the impact or the effect that the acting had. And it was intriguing keeping that in my mind last night, because I thought all of these actors are only thinking about the impact or the effect that they're having. They're not just doing it. And so for The Seven Ages of Man would be a classic example here, because it was what he was doing was using a series of cliched signs to tell us what he was doing. And Rosalind did the same thing at the moment when she fell in love with Orlando. There was an improbably long pause and a kind of a giggly tension thing, which people don't do. People do it when they want to show you that they've fallen in love with someone. And it struck me that the reason that actors might be doing that, this is picking up on what we've heard a bit about the director's process and gimmickry, is that they haven't got the security in what the director, in the process that the director is laying out for them in creating the production, and therefore they look for security elsewhere. And the security, it seems to me, that they're looking for is to know what it is that they are doing. The unfortunate result is that it uncovers a whole load of terrible cliches in their opinions, or in the production's opinions, some of them becoming offensive. So it struck me that that was a terrible problem of too much self-consciousness in what they were communicating to us. I could leave you with the question that perhaps it's a problem of reviewing, because once we've read Michael's very eloquent description of what Jude Law's Hamlet does and doesn't do, the temptation in creating our production is to try to do the things which it didn't do, or not do the things which it did do, and consequently we enter into a currency in the rehearsal room of talking about the effect that we want to have or to create, which it seems to me is a road to what you saw last night.
And as a take on that also feeds into the fact that they didn't seem to be really working fully as an ensemble, that they were all doing their own thing for their, so as we said, the lack of companionship, you know, that emotional bonding that I didn't feel that was present in that production.
But I if I could come in to defend that particular moment, and I think it may also be developing on what you've said in terms of the director's outside eye being able to provide an overall vision within which the individual contributions of the actors can fit. Because I heard The Seven Ages of Man that Forbes Marson did being criticised by, I think it was by Stanley Wells at the Royal Shakespeare Company, at the summer school, for being a sort of standalone vaudeville term, and maybe doing a disservice there. And so this time, when I saw it again, I paid particular attention to it because I was moved by it the first time I saw it. And I was moved by it again, almost to tears, this time. Because it seemed to me what he was trying to do, he was signaling, he was doing what in standard terms, if you're directing an actor, you say, don't do that, let the words tell the story, don't lay it on with all the bits and pieces. Except that, in the end, I thought he had the courage to become incredibly still for that very last line and stop performing. And it was, I thought, very, very moving. And then he stepped back, and then Ferdinand asked him to perform again after he'd exposed himself as an actor, after he'd been in the play, I mean, after he'd taken that chance, he'd not performed, and then he was asked to perform again. But, and I thought that was hugely subtle and very moving, it had no place to go because it wasn't being fed into an overall vision, because the danger and melancholy of the forest wasn't being reflected in the love scenes, and it was, you know, the whole thing didn't fit together. So I thought there were some wonderful, wonderful insights from the actors individually that just didn't, they were just left.
Well, that's intriguing. I mean, my take on that is that the play does a really brilliant thing at the moment, because at this moment where he says, where he gets to the end of the final age, then in comes Adam, Carrie, and giving us some food. And so dramaturgically, it's a really beautiful juxtaposition. I felt that he kind of wrecked that by trying to do it on his own, rather than allowing the play to do it.
Yeah.
But that's
yes, I mean, I agree, it didn't carry over into the... Maybe that's why that happened, I don't know.
Well, I think what you're saying is the production doesn't support that use of gesture. And I think it's... I mean, I'm quite intrigued in how a lot of directors direct, for actors using gesture. Because Jude Law's Hamlet is perhaps the most gesticulative Hamlet I've ever seen. And current psycholinguistic theory talks about gesture as an illustration or manifestation of cognition. And so, but at the same time, Jude Law's Hamlet was also the clearest Hamlet I've ever heard. And I don't know if those two things are connected. I also liked I liked what he did with that particular speech, but I felt that it was rammed into the production. Yeah.
In relation to that, so I've just been thinking about the earlier point you made about actors seeking to communicate what they're doing rather than just doing it, so that they're acting falling in love rather than falling in love. And your point, or someone's point about that relating to their lack of confidence from what the director has been helping them try to do. And I was thinking in directorial terms, there was a total lack of confidence in the story of As You Like It, so that when you've got to put in scenes that show Oliver leaving court with a gun over his shoulder so that we know that he is going to show up in Arden later on, what you're doing is taking away the beautiful improbabilities of that last sequence when suddenly Arden becomes as populous as the court was and is fantastically improbable and everyone's just popping up there. Because what you've done is try and turn it into a film narrative, and in the way you do when you get productions of Merchant of Venice that shows Shylock coming home to an empty house and you think, oh, Jessica has gone. It's that kind of literalness that actually slowed down the pace of the whole thing.
I just wanted to get in that I'm intrigued to see where this As You Like It fits in the current repertoire and all this stuff about Russia that's going on as well. And I can't help but wonder how much Michael Boyd has imposed something on this production that says, almost as soon as we got into Arden and they're all got Alex Snowing and we've all got our guns, I thought, oh, revolutions. And I think perhaps some of the flaws with this production are possibly, and I don't want to be too simplistic because I don't know, but possibly because it's almost, to me, As You Like It, when As You Like It comes around so frequently, it's a bums on seats. And I think in some ways this production answered that. It did all the comedy and everybody seemed to enjoy it so much, but I think it's also that making it fit something else that's going on within the company as well, and perhaps some of those flaws are because he's thinking too much maybe about Russia.
Perhaps it's missed a moment, but coming back to what Jeannie was saying about the speech, but perhaps it's symptomatic of the production that it becomes disjointed and segmented, because that's what happens to the speech. Rather than a unity, a flow, it was segmented because perhaps too much was done with the body. I don't think there's anything wrong with some mimicry, particularly with the voice of those moments. You know, peeps and whistles in his sound, but it needs to flow too, and it was too segmented, too disjointed.
Can I ask a question? I'll try this one about Reuben and Trafford. How many people here have seen this production more than once? I don't think there's anywhere else where you get quite such a significant number for whom repeat viewing is possible. And I ask because I think one of the things that we watch, those of us who do see a production being more than once, is how it changes over time. And I saw it very early on in April, connected with another conference. Here we are 4.5 months later, and there are many things that can happen to a production. And I think a good production, never mind about a great production, grows and changes. I don't mean it gets better. I mean that things happen which lead the actors continuing to live in the moment, to be invested in the work, to want to see where their participation in the show, where their character, where their own performance skills are going. And I think that poor productions fossilize and don't give the actors anything new to play with. And nothing has happened to this production in the intervening 4 months that seems to me to be positive. These actors are speaking in a way that knows exactly what the other person is going to do next. So there is that awful sense of anticipation, which is not about thrill and is not about possibility, but is about predictability. that nobody has found new aspects for themselves and who they are as actors, or for their characters as who they might be. So they stop being interested in the language except as display, as at a moment like that, or as something to be got through very quickly, because there is something else that I'm going to play, which is the thought, not the word. I'm going to play the idea behind this speech and not play the speech, and that's fatal. It's fatal in Shakespeare, and it comes for many actors from work in other kinds of drama in which they are being encouraged to play the thought and not the language. You discover the thought and then you let the language realise the thought, whereas in Shakespeare you discover the language and the thought appears out of the language. And so one of the difficulties that has come up quite often, Tom's point about you're playing at being in love rather than being in love, is because there is no investment in the language of love or the experience of love that the actor is able to find afresh each night across a very long run.
We've reached the last few minutes of the session. Janice, I know, was wanting to speak a moment ago, and Tim wants to say something. I'm going to jump in as chair again now in the last few minutes. Make sure Janice and Tim have their say.
Your question about how many times many of us have seen this play raises the point of, should one write one's review? Sent us back to someone questioned yesterday, should send one write one's review sort of after seeing it the first time or see it a few times. When I saw it in June, I came to Stratford for various reasons. I was rather tired and too many things on my mind. And that performance, I just didn't see time fly, and I came out, and that performance had a really cathartic effect. I saw it again yesterday. It didn't quite help that magic. I'd like to go back, though, to be trying to make sense of the overall design of the costumes, the time, and the changes of sense. Particularly, you know, the way these court girls from the court and Touchstone sort of, as it were, almost literally crash into the rural world, with Touchstone coming out all wrapped up in the hay and trying to get, sort of, they've moved out of court and crashed into this new world, and they don't know really what to make of it. The Rosalind's got difficulties handling the trolley, etc. And I, taking the issues of racism Paul mentioned, like when the Duke touches one of the servants by the chin, and then he does this with his hand, he's touched this dirty black skin, which is a peculiarly revolting moment, because you are actually touching, therefore meeting, and at the same time repelling. If you take then the Duke, the forest, perhaps because I come from France, I wondered if the director was trying to show us this sort of rural world of Arden as a world of where there's a resistance to an established order, and in the same place alongside these people who are trying to idealize this resistance. In the group, you've got a guy who's blind, he's got a problem, probably chilblains, probably lost his hands and cold. So this resistance world is not quite as idyllic as the hindsight people try to make out. And while there's this world of resistance going on, in the same place, a few hundred yards away, there are sort of peasant, traditional people going on with their lives as if time hadn't changed for them. And as if the time of Elizabethan England and the time of sort of 1940s were the same kind of place for the rural population. And that it's coming to terms with these moves in time, which are going to enable people to emerge out of this into this sort of post-war, sort of more golden world, and hence the costume, the dress Rosalind wears at the end, which is the kind of dresses people were wearing in the photographs you see of sort of post-1945 France after this sort of nightmare. And of course, with hindsight, we know it's not quite so simple. These touches of racism and darkness, and perhaps then it does make sense of this Ku Klux Klan cross, this sort of darkness of a civilization and the emergence of another one. And we as an audience are uncomfortable because we know it's not as simple as possibly the crime.
Thank you.
Sorry, I was too.
Thank you.
So very briefly, because I've really enjoyed these conversations. It's very rare be able to play it, being a critic or even thinking like a critic. And actually, I've been also really impressed at the quality of criticism that we've been hearing this morning. So very, very briefly, three things. One thing is that I would say, if I'm trying to be like a critic, just very simply, that I think the play is a riddle. It's a difficult riddle, and for me, a lot of what's been said is that the riddle wasn't quite solved in that production. I mean, it's a very hard one, and it wasn't quite solved. It was a muddle in some ways. Secondly, in terms of criticism, I think something a critic has to be careful of, and I think some of us would have to be careful of, is if we know something very well, we can appreciate something that actually is not very good theatre. It's actually quite boring theatre, but because we can see what it's doing, we can say, oh, that's good and that's clever. For me, The Seven Ages of Man's Speech is a good example. It just wasn't good theatre because it wasn't part of a scene. We shouldn't even have been talking about that. It's not a speech. It's part of action in a scene. And it was very cranky because it was just too much of an event. But we can conceptualise why it might be good or bad, but we know it too well. Just as a scene, as a moment in a scene, it wasn't happening for me. Thirdly, lastly, because it's a thing I feel very profoundly strongly about as a director, as a human being, and I would as a critic, you can't play working people as idiots. You just can't. And I think one reason why people like working with Michael so much is he's a very intelligent, very decent, very thoughtful man, and a very good director who did, I think, a lot of decent work in this show, especially the first hour. Simplicity, directness, all of that. But I don't get how we can think that Audrey, William, these guys are there, Phoebe, they can't be playing as stupid. It's not happening. And you said a very good thing. I think the difficulty is that too much we were watching people do things on stage that no one does in life. People don't behave like that in those rural communities or anywhere. And that, for me, is a profound issue of theatre, which as a critic I would hope I'd be able to pick up and locate.
Thank you. Thank you, all of you, for making this morning work. There's now a 5-minute break where we're all invited then to come back, and there's going to be an opportunity to reflect on the conference to make sure that we've all got evaluation forms to fill in. We'd love to circulate an email contact list as well, so we can establish maybe something like a group or a network which, you know, might come back for another conference at some point. And we'd love to have an opportunity to reflect on that until about 12:15. And then there'll be a closing drinks reception next door. So it's a 5-minute break now. And then if you take your belongings with you, so you have everything, then you can move the chair back into theatre style, that would be great.
Well, I'm